And welcome to the AVOD, where I, Count Vargelon,
and I, the Dive Mistress,
talk to you about some of the important genre issues of the day, and also edit out dead spots. That is another thing we do here at the AVOD. Today we're going to be following up on the Dive Mistress's ongoing John Carpenter issue, talking about a popular TV show, and of course, as always, going really in-depth into a movie that many people shouldn't care about.
Yes. So to get things started, I'm going to start talking about the next installment in the John Carpenter series. For people listening to this
the first time, introduce the concept of the theory.
Right, okay. Someone once told me that John Carpenter, descent into madness, can be tracked through his movie. So I've decided I'm going to watch them in chronological order to see where the turning point is. Also to see where my turning point is. If I go crazy before or after he goes crazy.
And so far you've watched?
Oh. So far I've watched Assault on Precinct 13.
Yes.
Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And The Fog.
Okay.
Did I leave anything out? Is that it?
No, yeah. That is it, because you did not see the resurrection of Bronco Billy or Elvis, which you are leaving out of this project because it's just professional theatrically released films you're dealing with.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And so today's feature is Escape from New York.
Ah, Escape from New York.
Yes. Kurt Russell. I want to say at his finest.
No, I think that's fair. There's a reason people only associate him with the character of Snake Plissken.
His eye-patched, tattooed finest.
Don't forget the leather pants. I don't know why you're forgetting the leather pants.
Those amazing leather pants. Are they leather or are they pleather? I think they're supposed to be snakeskin.
They're clearly not snakeskin.
Because his name is Snake. Well, his name is Snake.
Even still.
Yeah, those are totally supposed to be snakeskin pants.
Okay,
it's not camo.
Okay, then they're snakeskin pants. Whatever they're made out of, here's the big question. How crazy is this movie?
Okay, first of all, the crazy scale is out of 5.
Okay.
And so here in this movie, we got a spike in craziness because he was at 0 and then he got a 1 and then he went back down to 0 again. And this is a 2.5. He's halfway crazy.
Really?
With this film. Yeah.
I gotta say, I'm a little surprised by that.
Well, not a complete departure for him, because Assault on Precinct 13 is an action movie and Escape from New York is an action movie.
Yeah.
But it's totally different in other respects from the film that he's made before. I mean, he's still kind of got the minimalist thing going on.
Okay.
Very little dialogue. And when people speak, it does move the story forward. But he goes back to this weird pacing issue that he was experiencing in Assault on Precinct 13 and in Halloween.
I haven't actually watched recently. I've been careful to watch the other ones as we're going, but I was not able to pick up a copy of Escape from New York. So, I mean, I haven't seen this in about 2 years. I don't remember the huge pacing issues you're talking about.
Okay, he's on a time-sensitive mission.
He has one day to rescue the president before his neck blows up.
Exactly. And I think for our listener out there, mm-hmm. You have to understand that he's going into New York City, which is a maximum security prison.
Right.
And he has to rescue the president from the prison.
Okay.
Before his neck explodes, because he's been implanted with these time-sensitive capsules. So he's got 22 hours on the clock.
Okay.
And so he lands in New York at nighttime, and then most of the action takes place in that one night, and then he gets knocked unconscious.
And we skip the day.
And it is It's the following day. So there's okay. some, you know, some stuff happens during the day, and he's forced to fight this large Turkish man.
By the Duke of New York, Isaac Hayes.
The Duke of New York, Isaac Hayes, yes. And then when he's done with that, it's suddenly nighttime again.
Right.
And it's very abrupt. Yeah.
Yeah. So it seems like between this and Halloween, the thing you've noticed, and of course, Escape from New York, have you noticed a thing where he's very uncomfortable with what characters do during the day?
Yeah.
Like,
it's
he doesn't
true.
Really know what to do with people during the day.
Well, I think it's more that setting the action at night maybe creates, or he thinks kind of creates the mood and the atmosphere that he's really going for with these movies. However,
right.
I mean, a good part of the fog takes place during the day. And
it does, all of the investigation into the missing boat. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm kind of at a loss to explain why or how he goes back to this weird problem with the daytime.
You know,
that he had in his earlier film.
And what's interesting is, it's interesting you talk about the night film, because I believe the next film you're watching is The Thing.
That's correct.
Which is the John Carpenter movie I've seen second most of all of his films, right after Halloween. And an interesting thing about that film is, you know, it's day for like the first 20 minutes, and then it becomes a night that lasts for 6 months.
Yeah.
So it's like he found the solution to always wanting it to be night in his films by setting one in Antarctica.
Go to the Arctic.
The Antarctic.
It's Antarctica?
Yeah, because that's the thing's problem. It can't just walk out.
Oh.
Yeah.
See, I haven't watched it in a long time.
Yeah,
I mean, these are all things we'll discuss.
Yeah. If it was the Arctic, the thing could just walk to Canada, you know? But no, he's in the Antarctic, so he's got a problem. But rather than talk about The Thing, can I give the one piece of trivia I know about Escape from New York?
Yes, you can.
Thank you very much. At the beginning of the film, Snake hang glides into New York City. And while he's hang gliding into New York City.
Glides. No, he's in a glider. It's not a hang glider.
Oh, you're right. It's just a glider. Right. Okay. While he's gliding into New York City, there's a computer display of the city that he's looking at to guide him. And it's just primitive wireframes. But the film was so low budget and computer effects were so expensive at the time the film was made that instead of doing a computer graphic of New York, what they did was take white string, put it all over the miniature model of New York they had built, then slowly moved a camera through it with black light on it to make all of the white strings glow and everything else disappear.
Really?
Yes, it's not a computer effect. It's just him panning
That's
a camera.
That's amazing.
I know.
That is so cool.
Because that cheap an effect was so prohibitively expensive, it was cheaper to just use the model of New York they had built.
Right. That's outstanding.
I know. It really is great. Yeah, so that is the one piece of trivia I know about the movie Escape from New York. Also, I know that there is a famous deleted scene that somehow, despite being quite a fan of John Carpenter, I've never seen.
Oh, really?
The bank robbery from the beginning. I take it you did not see it either for this piece.
Well, no, I didn't. It's the theatrical release is what I saw, and I didn't even know there was a deleted scene.
Yeah, there's a deleted scene at the beginning where Snake is doing the bank robbery that he gets arrested for that causes all of his problems in the first place.
Oh, interesting. I think it's good not having it. It's effective because you meet the character.
Completely in medias
res.
Exactly.
And he's just arrived on Liberty Island to be processed before he's sent inside. And so you don't really know a whole lot about him. And then,
Yeah, just jumps right into it. And, okay, here's my question.
Exactly.
Is this the definitive Kurt Russell role?
I don't know. I haven't seen a lot of Kurt Russell movies.
Because
people
divide it between this and Captain Ron. So, you had to fall on one side or the other.
Captain Ron.
Captain Ron. Now you don't dig on the Captain Ron references.
Captain Ron.
Okay. So no, I think the most important question I have is, you gave this one a 2.5, by far the highest John Carpenter crazy we've seen. What's so crazy about the movie?
Yeah.
Beyond the Duke of New York and the Giant Turk.
Well, that is a big debt. That is crazy.
That is crazy.
And I think because problems that he'd had earlier in his career, which he had resolved in The Fog, come back to haunt him in this one.
Okay.
And there's no real reasoning as to why that should be.
Right, because he had grown as a filmmaker,
so I think that,
and then
that
seems
is
to
sort
regress.
Of a sense of craziness.
Okay.
Pardon me?
He had grown as a filmmaker, saying in The Fog, and been more controlled, and had better pacing,
yes.
And then all of that's gone for this one.
Exactly.
So, do you have any idea what could have caused
that?
So,
I think that's a sign of craziness. I think, in my opinion.
Okay. So, none of the concept of the film is what led you to describe it as crazy.
Well, it is. Well, that's a little bit crazy too. Also, I mean, okay. When the film there's a crawl at the beginning of the film, and it says, you know, it's 1988?
Yeah.
Or something like that, right at the beginning, and you know, sort of crime is spiraling out of control, and then suddenly it's like 97. Oh, no, this film was made in 81. So then it's 1997, and the crime is so bad that Manhattan Island has been converted into a maximum security prison.
Okay.
So like, it really dates the movie.
Yeah, it really does.
And so
it?
Sort of, it's set in the future, and none of his films up to this point had been set in the future.
Okay.
So, you know, that's a little different. And he does create this totally post-apocalyptic feel. Well, that's a film actually being post-apocalyptic, which
it's
is
interesting,
like, kind of crazy and kind of brilliant.
He supposedly has what they call an apocalypse trilogy, but this film is not part of it.
Again, I watch these films as they come to me.
Ah, so you're not really getting into
I really
the,
don't know anything about John Carpenter.
You're not really getting into the vernacular used by within John Carpenter fandom.
No, I'm not. Okay. And I'm doing my best to stay away from that because I don't want
No, that's absolutely good. You should be going
watching and readings of these films to be tainted or biased in any way.
I've always found the film interesting because it has one of the most clear instances of a MacGuffin ever.
What's the MacGuffin?
The tape that the president needs.
The tape?
Yeah.
That's the other thing, because he's always after... Well, he doesn't know he's after the tape until later on in the movie.
Yeah.
And also, the ending is incredibly pessimistic.
Yes, that's...
Because his other movies have had, like, you know, if not happy endings, everything's kind of resolved, and you get a sense that things are going to return to normal, and life will continue. But in this movie, when it ends, I don't want to give it away, but I'm going to, kind of.
Please give it away.
It doesn't have a happy ending. Because Snake is an asshole. Like, that's
yes.
his character. He's
a famous asshole.
From the start to the end. And so the
and
president...
And if ever you want a film without a character... With a character who does not have an arc or a through line or develop at all... Escape from New York, because that's how good a movie
but I
you
love
can
it,
have.
Though.
Oh, no, he's a wonderful character, but he doesn't develop at all over the course of the film.
Well, why do you always have to have your characters grow and develop?
I don't
people?
Think you do. I'm just saying many people say a film is bad when the writer does not have the characters
no character
grow and
development.
Develop. Yeah. Like Snake Plissken does not develop.
Prove them wrong.
Exactly. I think this film does prove them
wrong.
He's an. Anyway. Your point was he was an ass for the entire film.
Exactly. Yes. And so there's this. The president, when his plane crashes into New York City, he's got this tape recording on him, and the president's on his way to a very important summit, and this tape recording he's got with him is going to, I guess, create world peace and unity or something along those lines.
Or I don't know if it's create peace and unity so much as keep there from being a World War III.
Something along those lines. Well, you're not really sure, because when the president gets rescued and delivers his speech at the end of the film, he says he wants to share the information on the videotape in the hope of generating peace.
That's true.
But again, he's addressing the Soviet Union and China, so at the same time, he's just trying, it could very well be treated as just trying to avert a third, well, a nuclear war.
That's true.
But there's a, you know, this thing about tapes in the film, and at one point the tape gets switched for something else, and then when he plays what he thinks is his audio tape, it's a different tape altogether, and Snake destroys the original peace-bringing tape because he's just that much of a jerk.
Yeah, he is a classic ass. Yes.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a downbeat ending, yeah. And also you kind of, I don't know if it's like meant to sort of comment on the American political system or the president in particular. Because I think it was Reagan at the time. Was it? I don't know.
It was Jimmy Carter when the film was being developed.
Oh,
and, of
Carter.
Course, Reagan by the time it came out.
So you're not really sure how you feel about the president to begin with, because he's a victim in all of this. And Snake is just trying to get him out. And then, so towards the end of the film, the president, I guess, reveals his true colors. And he turns out to be a bit of an ass. And I think that's when Snake decides that he's not going to
help him save
help
the
him
world.
Bring peace to help him save the world, exactly.
Okay.
Like, you know, for the even if the prime minister or the president's an asshole, you know, it's for the betterment of mankind, and still Snake just doesn't give a crap.
He's a beautiful character, that Snake Plissken.
So, you know, that's kind of crazy.
It is. It is a little on the crazy side. I will absolutely give you that one.
Yeah. Like, Snake really has no redeeming qualities whatsoever. In a lesser film, he would, I guess, get over himself and over the tape.
But it's weird, because every character in the film, and this is going to be, maybe I'm overthinking this, but every character in the film, you know, treats him like he's a complete prick and assumes that that's what he is at all times. So it's not really a surprise
when
he turns around.
Well, he acts like a complete prick.
No, he does. But, you know, the president is never especially nice.
Well, he actually doesn't do anything. He just sort of stands there and doesn't – she kind of stares at you and doesn't say anything for a while.
Yeah, the president isn't especially nice to him even when he's being rescued by Snake Plissken. So it's not like...
Well, I mean, Cabby's really nice to him through the
Cabby
whole movie.
Is very
the
nice
Cabby's
to
really nice yeah. to everybody.
Yeah, the Cabby
Which
played by Ernest
makes
Borgnine?
Makes me wonder why he's in New York. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was a very nice character, absolutely.
Who I believe played Cabby in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Really?
Am I wrong about
he
that?
He was the was
I
he the voice
so.
Of the cabin?
I think he
who
played the taxi character.
Well,
I think so.
You know
I,
who
I like
can help us
so,
with this?
Because that would be awesome.
You know who can help us with this?
IMDb.
The Internet Movie IMDb. Database.
I know. God's gift.
It really is a useful service, isn't it?
But yeah, so the cabbie's such a he's such a nice guy, and I'm not really sure why he's in prison. Because you don't learn anything about the people that you encounter throughout the film. They're just, I mean, I believe all the bums were just stuck in New York. They were never shipped
well,
out once it was turned
I
into
mean, perhaps I'm wrong about this, but I always interpreted the cabbie still being New York as just he was a New York cabbie and he defined himself as a New York cabbie. And then when they shut down the city, he just refused to leave. Like he
no,
hadn't actually.
I'd like to think that he. I don't know. I'd like to think that he didn't choose to stay, just that he couldn't go.
Well, I'd always
Maybe
assume he hadn't committed a
New
crime,
York
but
over.
He just like, no, I'm staying. I'm a New York cabbie. This is what I do.
I don't know. I'd like to think that when they changed New York into a prison, only, you know, like the high society was warned and, you know, let to leave or helped out. But other people, like the bums, for instance, and the blue collar slobs and the working class, they weren't given any help or maybe really any warning.
You know, that is absolutely possible.
My
it was not him in
vision.
Yes, you have a much more bleak vision than I do. There was something oddly optimistic about my idea of him as a guy who defines himself so much as a New York cabbie.
The whole
movie
is really bleak.
It is a bleak film.
It paints a really bleak picture of human nature and the future of mankind.
If you think that's bad, wait until you see Escape from L.A.
It would make sense. And that envisioning of the future, it makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense that they would just
Cabbie
turn their back on the people who
didn't know
who lived
what
there.
Was happening around him.
Benny the Cab was voiced by Charles Fleischer, who was also Roger Rabbit. I'm sorry to say.
Ah, there goes my theory.
Yeah,
it
was
a
pretty bad theory, though. What a mean thing
to
say.
No, it was a really good theory.
You could read it that way.
Yeah, you're a jerk.
I'm just being a jerk for no reason.
I said it before, and I'll say it again.
Okay. So, by far the craziest John Carpenter film you've seen so far.
Yeah, the craziest yet.
Yeah,
absolutely.
By a wide margin. And what next
by
up is...
Yeah, because the other crazy one was Halloween, which I gave a 1.
Yeah. And, of course, next up is The Thing.
Yes.
By any definition, John Carpenter's best film.
That's true. It is fabulous.
Yeah, I mean, we've both seen this thing a number of times. We both have strong feelings about it, so I'm sure we'll be ready to discuss it. But I think it's fair to say that is, by a wide margin, his best movie.
His best movie, yeah. And I haven't seen it in a long time, so
really?
I sit down to watch this one again,
all right,
it'll be exciting for me.
Yeah, I'm such a The Thing nerd that I've read the short story and the novelization and an early script. I mean, I'm just a complete The Thing nerd.
Oh, my God.
I know, it's crazy. So,
seen the original, like the old black and white one?
Of course, yeah.
I've seen that.
Yeah, that is
totally
something we can discuss
movie.
When
completely
we discuss...
Different thing.
When we're discussing The Thing, we can also discuss The Thing from Another World and how it's a much worse movie, despite what film critics at the time said.
Revisionism.
Because there were many film critics at
Wonderful
the time
thing.
Who were very pissed off at John Carpenter for quote-unquote ruining The Thing. And we can get more in-depth into
true.
This.
That's true. It got terrible reviews. People
we can go into this more in-depth next week. Actually, no, we're going to be taking next week off to do the Christmas special. So in the new year.
Christmas special, that's right.
By the way, folks, we're doing a Christmas special next week, so yay! Not how I plan to announce it, but in the essence of time. We can get more into this next time, but I think there's nothing that I fear greater than people 20 years from now talking about Rob Zombie's remake of Halloween and how it makes the original completely irrelevant, the way I, with complete confidence, say that about John Carpenter's Thing as opposed to The Thing from Another World.
No, I don't think that's going to happen.
It's probably not going to happen, but it's what I'm scared of happening. And, okay, it's probably an irrational fear, but it's there nonetheless.
Because if anything, I mean, I argue that Rob Zombie's Halloween just introduced a new generation of horror fans to the original Halloween and how wonderfully brilliant it is.
You know, I hope that... Gosh, I hope that's the case. And that would be the opposite of my experience with The Thing from Another World, because The Thing introduced me to The Thing from Another World, a film that I was not at all entertained by.
Well, see, I mean, it could go either way, but just because, you know, Halloween is an amazing movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's no doubt in my mind that Rob Zombie's Halloween
is just god-awful.
Well, I mean, there's that. But then it helped, you know, it kind of created maybe a resurgence in popularity for the original.
All right. Before we move on to a little something called Fringe, or the Fringe-pocalypse, if you will, I'd just like to point out that Charles Fleischer was is a popular voice actor. And as a result, he was in a number of films, and the film that I'm most puzzled by is Balto. Do you remember Balto?
Why does that... I never watched...
It was that weird animated film about a heroic husky.
I know, it's about a dog.
Yeah, and
isn't
apparently...
Isn't it about the Iditarod?
Yes, and apparently they made a bunch of direct-to-video sequels to it.
Yes.
That was just the random thing I wanted to point out there.
Okay, it's time to close down IMDb.
Okay, I am closing IMDb now. All right, now, since the show Fringe premiered, you have been, and I have been, attempting to become fans of the show Fringe.
Yes.
We have not been helped in this. We have not been helped in this area by the show Fringe at all.
No. You know, the pilot was so good. It was exciting, and it was filmed in Toronto.
Really, isn't that all you need?
And then I watched the second episode, and it was less good, and I don't think it was filmed in Toronto. And then I kept watching, and I kept wondering whether or not I liked the show, if I was enjoying it at all, if I even really cared about what was happening. And then I missed an episode because I was busy, doing my schoolwork. I realized that I didn't care that I had missed an episode, and I wasn't going to bother to catch up and then sit down and watch the next one.
Wow. And when did this happen?
So I've given up on Fringe. This happened 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I didn't see this week's episode. I didn't see the one before that.
Given how hard we've been trying to like Fringe, you'd think the show Fringe could kick in a little. And help out.
Well, that's what I was waiting for. Because they had a good episode where they moved the story forward and things got a bit more interesting. And then they had a really boring episode after that. And then I got bogged down in papers and finals, and I missed an episode and realized that...
You weren't going to bother trying to watch it.
It's not the end of the world for me.
Seeing if anyone had taped it or anything like that. Yeah.
Exactly.
So you missed...
When I get wrapped up in a show and I miss an episode, like, I got to find out what happened. I got to get a hold of that as soon as possible.
So the episode you missed is, you saw the one where the guy had a parasite wrapped around his heart, right? You saw that episode.
I saw the one after that.
And you saw the one after that about the child who had been kidnapped in order to do a musical formula.
Yes.
Okay. Kidnapped by the guy who had something wrapped around his heart. Who had been revealed to be...
Oh, that was the same guy.
Yeah, you didn't know that was the same guy? Yeah, he was revealed to be evil at the end of the episode thing wrapped around his heart.
I guess I just was so little interest in what's happening. I didn't even notice it was the same dude.
Wow, that is pretty bad. But anyway... So yes, that happened. It was the guy who had something wrapped around his heart, and then they did another episode where people were being drugged with toad venom and caused to have scary dreams so real that the things that happened in their dreams actually happened to their bodies.
I did see that one.
Oh, you watched it and then you just completely forgot it right away.
I guess it was the following one that I missed. I did see that one, yeah.
Okay.
And then the guy said at the end of the show, he told What's-Her-Face, Olivia, that the pattern was just a smokescreen and Massive Dynamic was behind the whole thing.
Yes, which, by the way, everyone watching figured out from the first episode.
So really not a big revelation.
Well, what stunned me so much about the show is they established that basically everything the pattern involved in had been research that Joshua Jackson's, that Pacey's dad had been involved in throughout, the 60s and 70s, right? And a little,
right, and
I guess,
he had this research partner.
Research
who
partner.
Has the same initials as he's got,
yes.
And we have never seen.
I know.
Which leads me to conclude this person isn't actually real,
well,
and it is, in fact, Pacey's dad.
That's what I keep thinking, that the reason no one's ever seen William Bell is that all the time he was in an insane asylum, he was, I guess, multiple personality style running this corporation. And
possibly. Or they just created this character, William
to
Bell.
To use his research, yeah. But he does.
Well,
no, but he remembers working with William Bell, and I think the reason he remembers working with William Bell is
because
William Bell is a schizophrenic creation of his own mind.
Right.
Yeah, but
yeah.
And that's why, you know, that's why William Bell disappeared the second he got out of the insane asylum.
Exactly.
But yes.
Not hard to figure out.
Yeah, in the first episode, you know,
is everyone on the show? Why haven't they come to these conclusions?
Well, though, on the first episode of the show, you know, I just started thinking, why doesn't anyone realize that it's clearly William Bell? And then as the show progressed, you're like, oh, well, there's obviously no William Bell, and it's just a creation of his mind. But, yeah. But the show is acting like this is a huge mystery when they flat out told us that he is responsible, personally, for every single weird thing the pattern has done. You know?
It's true.
Like, when they've already told us that he's personally responsible for all this, why are we supposed to think it's a mystery who's behind the pattern?
Yeah.
Oh, and I just want to make this absolutely clear. The show wants us to know that Olivia, is the main character Olivia? Is
Olivia
the worst detective in the world? Because in the episode, well, first off, if you watch the show, you'll notice that Lance Reddick, her boss, you know, got her because it's like, I need you because you're the best detective I got. And it's going to take a great detective to track down, you know, this pattern. But then if you watch the show, she never actually does anything. Like, ever.
She doesn't actually do any detecting.
Not only does she no detecting, she basically does nothing. Basically, she stands around until Pacey tells her something, and then she just goes and arrests someone. Like, literally, it could be anyone.
Well, no, she goes. She visits Massive Dynamic and keeps getting offered a job.
Keeps getting offered a job, and then telling the boss of Massive Dynamic, who's clearly evil, everything that's going on in her investigation. In, I think her low point as a detective came in episode with Killer Butterflies, when she's got someone who flat out tells her Massive Dynamics behind it all, they're pure evil, and I can give you the evidence if you keep me safe. So then, instead of in any way trying to keep him safe, like, you know, moving him to a safe house and then waiting until she has evidence against Massive Dynamic, she walks out of his hospital room, runs across town, and says to the head of Massive Dynamic, hey, I know you're behind the pattern, and I'm going to prove it if you give me a chance to interview this guy I've got hidden away. Here's a better plan. Instead of driving all the way across town to tell the person that you're investigating that they're being investigated so they can put their guard up, stay with the guy until you have all the evidence against him and then confront them.
I know, it was so stupid.
Like, I was shocked by her utter ineptitude as a detective. Like, what is she... As I watched that scene, I was just dumbfounded that someone could be doing something so stupid, and that we, the audience, are supposed to think that she's clever.
I know. And then they also, I believe in that same episode, they tried to give Pacey... I feel terrible calling him that.
Why?
I don't remember his character's name.
Yeah, what is his character's name?
Because, you know, he hasn't been Pacey for, like, 15 years.
I know, but that doesn't make him not Pacey. And by the way, it's only been, like, 10 years since the end of Dawson's Creek.
Okay, I'm sorry. 10 years.
I'm not
going
to go to the Internet Movie Database to check that out. I am.
No.
But I'm pretty sure it's only been 10 years. His name is Peter Bishop.
Peter Bishop. There you go.
There you go.
They tried to give Peter some backstory.
Oh, God. How did Dawson's Creek only end 5 years ago?
Are you kidding me?
It feels like it ended so long ago, but it's only been 5 years.
You're so much longer than that. 5 years ago? Really?
2003?
No.
Wow. Okay.
Jesus, because I had a friend. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Because I had a friend who was not working for a while and spent his days watching Dawson's Creek. And then it finished, and I made fun of him because now I said you have to get a job because Dawson's Creek is finished. It's reruns.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. Okay, so yeah,
5 years
Pacey,
ago. All right.
Yeah. Oh,
Bad
okay.
Story.
Pacey
Right.
Witter was apparently.
So you have to fill me in on what I've missed now,
oh,
and I'll
I'm
try
sorry.
Not to get bored.
Okay. No, I mean, at the end of the in the new episode, I'm just going to fill you in quickly in the new
Because I missed
episode.
two.
No, you haven't missed
I think
two. You
there's
just missed
one
one.
where they like. No, I've missed. No, because there's one where they go through. Because at the end of the episode with the kidnapped kid.
Yeah.
He's able to reach through walls.
Yes. And then they took
the
a break for a week to do the Killer Dreams episode, the Killer Nightmares
yeah.
episode, and then the next episode was the last episode, the one they went through walls.
Oh, I thought I missed two.
No, you just missed the one. And I don't want to be a jerk, but the second they see you see that the technology exists to let you walk through walls, that then the absolute next thing that happens is, well, I guess someone's going to get stuck in a wall, right? And of course, that is the absolute first
yes.
thing that happens in the next episode. Oh, man. And I'm not saying the show is anti-feminist, but the main character cries all the time and is terrible at her job, yet everyone treats her like she's a genius anyway, probably so she won't feel bad about herself. I'm sorry, she's a terrible main character. Just, she's one of the worst main characters we've
well,
had in
it's not her fault she's badly written.
No, it's
poorly
not.
Written.
It's not her. It is her fault she looks like she's going to cry all the time.
And that is true. A
but
strange
that could be...
choice on the part of the actor.
Yeah, it's a really strange choice in the part of the actor to look like she's just always on the verge of tears. But the rest of it, you're right, is not her fault. I'm not going to blame
yeah.
Anna Torv for that. Apparently that is the actress's name. Anna Torv. I'm going to say it doesn't sound like a real name, but you know what? Maybe I'm just being a jerk again. It was all... So they stole a bunch
so you're
of things.
Gonna keep...
I am going to keep watching Fringe.
Yes, okay.
And I wish I could stop watching Fringe, but... It's about time you learn this about me, that everyone learned this about me. I have a disturbing disorder by which, if I start watching a television show, I cannot stop watching it for any reason.
I know.
I just can't do
it. I remember receiving phone calls every Sunday night. You heaving a heavy sigh because you just watched another terrible episode of The Simpsons.
Which I still do.
Although the phone calls have stopped.
Well, yes, because you really got very angry at me telling you about The Simpsons. And I gotta say, there is no one I am impressed more by than, you know, my associate Merman, because just years ago, he said, you know what, I'm not doing it anymore. I hate The Simpsons. It makes me sad and angry every week. I'm just not watching it. And he's stuck to that. He hasn't watched a new episode of The Simpsons in, like, 8 years.
Yeah, me neither.
I know.
Maybe by accident.
I respect you people so much. Although, he did see The Simpsons movie. Which...
Oh, I even passed on that one.
I would have advised he not see. But, what are you going to do? But yes, I am going to continue watching Fringe to see if it gets better. At the end of the last episode, they used the machines from out of the, it turns out Walter had built a set of surveying cameras that if you aimed all three of them at a certain point on the Earth and set their dials right, they could snatch anyone from any time in history and bring them to the present.
What?
Yeah. They could reach
they snatch?
The guy who was in the jail in Germany.
Oh.
Yeah, so I gotta say, if you're...
Yeah, that
if
whole
got,
Little Hill thing. What the F?
Oh, yeah, and Little
Seriously.
Hill...
Seriously.
By the way, Little Hill was just the place where they had to set up the machines.
Really?
Yeah, that's all Little Hill was.
That's so lame.
Yeah, it's pretty lame. And by the way...
Where does the gentleman live?
Yeah, and I'm like, where does the gentleman...
I mean, come on.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. But what I find interesting about it is, and I think interesting is massively overstating my feelings towards it, but I'll use it for now. What I find interesting about the whole situation is that they spent all this time building up that little hill thing, and then it's like, no, that's just where they're grabbing him. But more importantly than that, you just got a machine that will let you grab anyone from out of history or time or space and bring them here. And the best you can do is some super criminal from Germany. Like, I know he's your boss.
Seriously.
I get that. I get that he's your boss, but there's so many more interesting things to do. It's like, do you remember the movie Last Action Hero?
I never saw it.
You never saw Last Action Hero? Oh my god, you make me sad.
No.
Okay. The character, the villain gets a magic ticket that will let him bring go into movies and bring any character out of a movie, okay? So suddenly the villain has the ability to grab any character from the history of cinema and bring them into the real world to act as his henchman. So who does the villain grab with all of history to go from? He grabs... I think he was named the Reaper or the Ripper or something. Tom Noonan serial killer play, the Tom Noonan played serial killer character from a previous Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. So of all the people in all of history he could have gotten, he grabbed the one villain that Arnold Schwarzenegger's character had already defeated.
Right.
So it's like, why would you pick the one guy that you know this guy can beat? Yeah, it was a poor choice. And I know that this film, that this set of surveying cameras they got couldn't, you know, grab anyone from all of fiction, but apparently anyone from all of history, so...
It's wide open.
Oh, and they also kidnapped Olivia Dunham. So, you know, that's good too. Yeah. They also kidnapped her to interrogate her because it turns out they need to know something that John Scott knows. And because his consciousness is inside her head, they figure they can, you know, do some sort of a brain sucking machine on her and find out what he knew.
Well, how do they know that his brain is in her head?
Because the last image his eyes saw were her. Because they also have one of those machines that lets them see the last image you saw before someone died. Apparently everyone has that machine.
But in a previous episode, that didn't work.
No, don't you remember? It traveled down the optic nerve. And they were able to, you know, check the thing on the optic nerve. It didn't work well, and at Massive Dynamics, they have a better version of the machine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like, they were actually able to find it. And
so that guy works for Massive Dynamics, then?
Who? The FBI agent?
The guy with...
No. The guy... Oh, you mean the guy in prison? Yeah, that's not really...
Yeah.
Yes, he does. I was about to say it's not really clear, but no, it's completely clear. He does. Yeah, he works for Massive Dynamic. He's a mysterious figure. He's the show's... One of the show's, you know, continuing villains. So we'll see what they do with that next week, which you may or may not be interested enough to have me tell you about. Probably not.
I can tell you right now, probably not.
Okay.
No,
so
I'm parting ways with Fringe.
So for the record, Fringe just got too boring to be bearable.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. For a 50-minute show, terribly boring.
Well, I keep telling you, that was their mistake.
Like, there's a lot of action.
It was adding eight
minutes.
There's
a lot of exciting stuff happening, but it's so friggin' boring.
I know.
Yeah, no, I argued it wasn't because the show is too long.
Right.
It's just because it's very badly written.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
I'll give you that
minutes.
One. So, now we have to... Also, the villain's name is Nina Sharp. And I think that's just a silly name.
Yes.
Just think that's a silly name, unless you're like a razor-sharp playing card-themed villain. Which she's not.
Oh, God.
How much more interesting would that show be, though?
Well, Sharp could be, like, her mind.
It could be, but, you know...
You know.
She's treacherous, but we haven't seen that she's particularly clever.
Maybe you gotta wait.
Very mean thing for me to say. All right, so Moving on. Now we're going to talk about the main event, if you will. A movie that I forced you to watch against your will.
Another one.
Yet another one.
There's been many.
Although, to be fair, I think this one was less painful than most.
Well,
it didn't involve any twisted bondage families.
That's true.
Like a
and
certain,
it is keeping on the whole keeping me as bored as possible theme. While, you know, watching TV.
Oh, my God. Which is, you know, so it's one up on Blood and Sex Nightmare, if nothing else.
Yeah.
It's certainly better than that film.
Yes,
which,
it is.
Which, if anything, I gotta say, if there was ever something you would want to be able to put on the poster of your movie, it's that it is better than Blood and Sex Nightmare. Yeah. That film is, of course, Jumper. A film that I find incredibly fascinating for reasons that I will get into after you have told me your reaction to the film.
Well, I watched it. I had to watch it twice.
Okay.
Okay, I told you that I watched it twice, but I actually lied.
So wait, I'm not clear. Did you watch it or did you watch it twice?
I have seen it in its entirety.
Once.
Let's just leave it at that.
Okay.
I've seen the whole film.
All right.
I didn't watch it twice.
Okay.
It took two viewings to get through it.
It's a very
technical reason.
It's a very... Okay, I thought it was because it was a very boring film, which it is.
No, well, there is that. It was extremely boring. At one point, I did consider shutting it off and telling you that I wasn't going to finish watching it. But then the movie, Then I couldn't watch the end of the movie because I was having technical problems.
Okay.
And then I told you that I couldn't watch the end. I didn't really care to see it. And you told me I had to go back and watch Shell Over from the beginning and see it all the way through. So what I did was I went back to where I had stopped watching it and just watched it. Because I couldn't bring myself to sit through all that again.
Right.
Because it's really boring.
Okay, that's fair. Oh, my God. So, your reaction to the film, please. Other than the boringness.
Well, that's just it. Had a lot of potential.
It did.
But it goes nowhere.
No, it doesn't.
And it takes a long time to get there, too. Like, it's just this guy, he develops the ability to teleport.
Yes.
Meanwhile, his mom ran out on him when he was 5, and he was raised by his...
His drunken father, played by beloved character actor. Are you not going to jump in with the name of the beloved character actor who played his dad?
No, I'm not.
Michael Rooker. Beloved character actor Michael Rooker.
There we go.
Famous for being Henry Portrait,
anyway,
the serial killer.
Yes. That's right.
That is. So, anywho.
So, he develops the ability to teleport.
Or jump.
And this happens when he's... Or jump. This happens when he's 15.
Yes.
And then he spends the next 8 years.
Yeah.
Just robbing banks.
Robbing banks and casinos.
Like.
Yeah.
Robbing banks and casinos. And he gets this like apartment in New York. And he's sort of living the high life. And then. And what happens? Then he decides
Samuel
he's
Jackson
go home
shows up
for some reason.
Samuel Jackson shows up at his apartment and says, "I'm going to kill you because you're a jumper."
Exactly. You don't know, yeah, because he's like a paladin, and paladins kill jumpers.
Yes.
Not really too sure why. Something about jumpers shouldn't be allowed to do what they do. Only God can have that power. So the film's got this like weird.
A message that I will get into
godly...
in a minute. Religious intolerance.
Anyway,
yeah.
So then he goes home, finds his old, the girl that he had a big crush on for his entire life.
Yep.
Takes her to Rome.
Yes.
Then
gets attacked by the paladins again.
Gets attacked by the paladins. That's right. Again. Meets another jumper.
Yeah.
Sends the girl packing.
Yeah.
And then he follows this other jumper around before he manages to convince him to join forces to kill Samuel Jackson.
Well, what's really interesting is he doesn't really have to convince him that hard because...
Because the guy goes around killing paladins anyway.
Anyway, and he wants... The big conflict in the film is Jamie Bell, famous for being Billy Elliot, the other jumper, wants to use the fact that his girlfriend, that Hayden Christensen's girlfriend is going to be a magnet for the paladins to set a bomb in her apartment and blow up the head of the paladins, Samuel L. Jackson, whereas his friend, obviously Hayden Christensen, wants to rescue his girlfriend and not worry about killing Samuel L. Jackson. Which leads to a ridiculous chase where they jump all over the world chasing each other. Because jumpers, and this is a key element, can jump through each other's jump scars to another part of the world. So if a jumper goes
and
somewhere...
And you can only jump to a place that you, like...
Have been.
Been to or know.
Yeah, or know clearly. So if you have a picture of a place, but you've never been there, you can jump there as long as you can clearly picture it in your mind. So there are, and I'll give it this, there are rules to and limits to what the jumpers can do that the film follows, but, you know, not very well.
And well, like I said, I mean, it's a really interesting idea, and you can do a lot with it.
The film just refuses
to. It's so poorly executed.
Well, very little happens in the movie.
And it, like, sets up, I know. It sets up this, like, sort of epic, ongoing battle between jumpers and paladins that's been, you know, this sort of war, if you will, has been waging since time immemorial. But you don't really understand why.
Yeah.
And it's like, these jumpers, they're not hurting anybody. They're not doing anything wrong. So maybe Hayden Christensen's a bank robber. So what?
Well, here's the thing.
You know, he's not going around killing people for no reason, like the paladins.
Here's the thing I find interesting, is that the film, I came away with a very different feeling to it than you do, obviously. Because the thing that fascinated me so much about this movie, I'll admit, I was fascinated by it, was that if you look at it clearly, I mean, if you think about it, first off, there's a joke made in the film about the comic book Marvel team up and how the two jumpers should have a Marvel team up to battle
team up. Yeah.
And first off, you would never have a Marvel team up between two characters with the exact same power. You know, that just wouldn't be interesting. But what I found more interesting than that is that the movie actually goes to the trouble of kind of setting itself within a, how do I put this, within a comic book sort of milieu. That's right, I said milieu, right? You know, because he's got superpowers and there's guys chasing him and they have a team up and all that. But the weird part is, if you look at the movie, it's not the story of a superhero. It's the story of a supervillain.
Kind of.
Like, if you watch that movie seriously and you think about it, it's basically the story of a supervillain who goes around doing whatever he wants whenever he wants with no care about anyone else and the people he robs and the people he hurts. You know, doesn't think about it in the least. You know, he's completely self-centered. There's a pointed moment at the beginning of the film when he's sitting in his apartment watching, you know, a disastrous flood somewhere in South America. And it's like, and the newscaster, you know, announces, rescue isn't going to get here in time. Only God could help these people now. And we know that the character...
And you expect him to go there and save them.
And he doesn't. He lets those people that he could save die because he's too self-centered. Now, in a normal film, he might receive some comeuppance for this fact and learn a lesson and then have to sacrifice something to save people later on. But he doesn't. He never does. He never learns to be a better person. For the rest of the film, he kind of stays a supervillain. And I find that fascinating because this is essentially a movie That's never happened before. That they made a movie about a supervillain. And what's stranger is the film doesn't seem to realize that it's about a supervillain. Well, a funny line is it's like when he's having his quote-unquote ethical...
Then that would make Sam Jack the superhero.
No, you don't have to be a superhero to fight supervillains. He's still a prick. Like, Sam Jack is still a prick. But he has much more motivation for his actions than the film seems to think. Because there's a hilarious line in the movie where he's like, where he says that all jumpers turn bad. And Hayden Christensen's like, how do you know I will? To which I respond, will? You've already turned bad. You go around robbing banks. You know, like...
Yeah, he maintains that he's different. And at the end, he's like the most powerful jumper ever.
Yeah. Like, exactly. He ends up being the most powerful jumper ever.
And then there's this unresolved issue with his mother.
Yeah.
And then there's this really odd thing where jumpers are only male.
Yeah, that is weird. But
which I thought was really
far stranger is the film seems to, and I'm sure I'm going to do a whole article about this, but the film seems to, how do I put this, not understand, you know, the kind of awful, like, it doesn't seem to think they're, how do I put this, the character of David, the main character, does not feel he's responsible for the bad things he does. Like, he feels no responsibility for all the people he's hurt by stealing their money and stealing their property. And, you know, I'm sure all the traffic accidents
he's caused.
Well, he
does at the beginning because he says he's going to pay the money back.
Yes, but he's had 10 years and he's never paid any money. Like, he does leave IOUs, which is funny, but he's never, you know, made an attempt to get a career or get a job or any way to find money that he could then pay back.
Or even to learn how to use a door properly.
Exactly. Or even, he doesn't even know how to use a door. Like, he is so...
He's like the laziest bastard ever, because there's a scene where he's sitting on the couch and the remote's at the end of the couch.
Yeah,
so
and so
he jumps over to where the remote is.
Which, again, a very funny scene, but it makes the... But it, while they're doing a comedy scene, they are actually successfully making the point that he is fundamentally a bad person. He's not a good person. He's a terrible human being. You know, he's...
Everyone in that movie is a terrible person.
Except for Samuel L. Jackson, who, you know, is the only one who's taking the...
He's terrible, too.
He seems to be the only one who's taking responsibility of getting rid of these jumpers. Like...
But we don't know anything about the other jumpers that he's killed. We just have his word that they've all gone bad.
But
we don't know that, and he's set up as being untrustworthy.
Is he? Because the only jumper we've
on killing these people.
The only jumper we've met, you know, at the beginning of the film, has gone bad and is, you know, a bad person who, you know, goes around the world stealing from people, and the other one, you know, just enjoys killing people.
He enjoys killing paladins. He doesn't kill anybody else.
Actually, he does.
And
if you watch the film,
he's justified in that because.
If you watch the film, he kills two other people without worrying about it or being in the least bit concerned. During Jamie Bell's character, Billy Elliot Jumper, he can jump anything that's moving, no matter how big it is. That's his special ability. Right.
Yeah.
And when Samuel Jackson is hanging out at his desert ranch, he teleports to London. Grabs a bus with a driver in it, and then teleports the bus with a driver in it into a spectacular crash in the middle of the desert, killing that bus driver.
You don't know that he's dead.
Well, he was in a horrific...
You can argue that you don't know that guy's dead.
He was in a... But my point isn't whether he's alive or dead. My point is that Jamie Bell shows reckless disregard for human life.
But still, I mean, you can argue, though, that it's a me or him situation. And so he's doing everything he can.
Yes, but if
getting killed.
But if everything you can involves killing random bystanders, then you see how it's not a moral act.
I don't know. You don't know that they're dying. I don't know. Because you can argue
then
that
later,
he didn't die.
When he's just having a fight with Hayden Christensen, he grabs a truck with a driver in it, and hurls that at Hayden Christensen, and they all wind up in the war-torn, you know, streets of Kosovo while a gunfight is going on. Something tells me that Mexican truck driver isn't going to do too well in the middle of a Kosovar battlefield.
Again, he's alive when you last see him.
What I'm saying
and
is
nothing exists outside the the confines of your TV screen. It doesn't matter if the guy is alive or dead later on in the film. He's alive when you last see him. Therefore, Billy Elliot didn't kill him.
Whether he's dead or not, the very fact that Billy Elliot is doing these things demonstrates that he has a reckless disregard for human life, which the Paladins at no point demonstrate.
You don't know that.
Well, we're taking this based on your...
Yeah, but Samuel Jackson killed Hayden Christensen's father for no reason.
He did kill him for a reason. He's trying to end the genetic line to make sure no more jumpers are born. He has more of a reason than anybody else.
But that's just as bad as what Billy Elliot is doing, if you want to argue that.
No,
they're
I would argue that
they're both morally reprehensible,
is...
all of them.
I would argue that while both are morally reprehensible actions, because he's trying to keep there from being more, evil jumpers in the world, Samuel Jackson's actions are more morally justifiable than Billy Elliot's, because Billy Elliot is killing random bystanders to preserve his own criminal murderous life.
I see you can't say things like that because you don't know that he has a criminal murderous life.
Except that we see him kill a bunch of people.
But that's only... First of all, you don't see him kill anybody.
Okay, we see him demonstrate a reckless disregard.
And this is only in his fight against the Paladins. You don't know what he does when he's not hunting Paladins.
Actually, we know that he doesn't do anything but hunt Paladins. They establish that.
He could be saving puppies.
No, but
you don't know.
Everything he does demonstrates a complete reckless disregard for human life. He steals a car and then jumps
it
around the streets.
Everybody does in that movie is a reckless disregard for human life. It's a terrible film full of terrible people.
Except my point is that Samuel Jackson, we don't see him randomly killing people. Like, he doesn't kill random people who have witnessed jumping or anything. Like, he doesn't do... He only kills the people he absolutely has to, and he seems to feel pretty bad about it. Whereas, by comparison... He seems to.
How can you argue that he feels bad about killing the people he does, and he's got this weird ritualized behavior that he indulges in when he's about to kill the jumpers?
Because ritual...
That's not a sign of feeling bad about what you're doing. That's a sign of it being ingrained into you from years of doing this. So you've
also
got a special knife for it that you carry around wrapped up in a special cloth, and there's something that you got to tell these people before you kill them.
Ritual is something that you use to remove emotion from the act of murder, which actually suggests that he did feel bad about what he's doing and has developed a ritual to salve his conscience.
That is so not true.
Now, did you ever think that you would be having a moral argument about the film Jumper?
No.
It is
I really
shocking.
Don't want to be either.
It is a shocking turn of events, isn't it? No,
let's talk about his hairdo instead.
Yes, let's talk about his... Oh, no, and I do want to point out that Hayden Christensen bitches about how he feels he's morally better than Samuel Jackson because he's not a killer. And I'm like, well, you did jump those four agents into the deepest part of a river inside of a house. So I think they're probably
dead. I know, right?
And then the best part is, he says this to Samuel Jackson after he has left him in a desert cave at the top of a cliff with no way to get out or be rescued. And I'm like,
yeah.
You're a killer, so I'm better than you because I'm not a killer. Now, you're going to die of thirst in this mountain cave. Like, what? How does that make you morally better than Samuel L. Jackson if you just left him to die on top of a mountain? Now, because he's a film villain, we assume he will escape. But Hayden Christensen has no way of knowing that he's going to be able to escape because he doesn't have a phone or anyone to call. Yeah, so I thought that was kind of funny.
It's...
That Hayden Christensen acts like he's morally superior, but he's not.
It has I mean, there are lots of possibilities.
Oh, absolutely.
For the story, it could have gone in so many different directions, and instead it went nowhere.
Yeah, it did. Because after, you know, the film, the inciting incident is he was such a bad thief that, you know, Samuel Jackson wasn't able to find him. And then the rest of the film is just a chase where he keeps, you know, leading Samuel Jackson directly to people he loves. So that Samuel Jackson can put them in danger to try and catch him. Like, he's he's terrible at this. Like, seriously, like, I understand him reflex jumping home because that's what you do when you're in danger. You reflex jump to the place you felt most comfortable, which for him was that library of his childhood, right? Mm-hmm. Or wait, I guess when he gets attacked, he doesn't jump to the library of his childhood, which would make sense. He jumps back to his childhood... like bedroom, which actually makes less sense than him keeping
his room.
Yeah, which he really should have jumped to the library.
His first jump ever took him to the library.
And then so was the second jump. Like, so, and then later in the film, when he rescues himself and Rachel Bilson, he goes back to the library. So the film established that's where he feels most safe. Yet when the paladin attacks him, he jumps back to his home just to bring Michael Rooker back into the movie. Like, there's... like, from a plot standpoint, there's no reason for him to jump back to his room. Sorry about that. Mm. Anyway, but then the first thing he does is, even though he knows that now there's someone who knows he's a jumper and is trying to kill him because he's a jumper, he gets into a fist fight with a bully from his high school and then uses his jumping abilities in public to beat up the bully. Like, did you not see the problem that might cause? But it's like, it's a movie about a profound...
He just didn't think this through, that's all.
No, I just find it interesting that
he's
it's a
irrational
movie
and
about
impulsive.
A profoundly stupid, impulsive character who's a criminal that we're still supposed to like.
Well, a high school dropout, too. So really, I think the overall message here is to stay in school.
Oh, if anything. If there is a message... I'm going to throw out a couple of my favorite things from the film, which is the first time he goes to rob the bank, he uses the bathroom to find out where the vault is so he can picture it, right? And then he jumps into the bathroom.
That's kind of smart.
No, it absolutely is. Then he jumps into the bathroom. So instead of trying to jump into the vault, which he doesn't know if he could do, he jumps into the bathroom, then looks at the vault door so he can imagine jumping to the other side of it. It actually goes into how his powers work. But then the funny thing is the next day – they're like, how do you, the bank manager is like, how do you break into a bank without, you know, opening any doors? It's a mystery. Like, we didn't even know there had been a robbery or anything was wrong until we opened up the vault and all the money was missing. To which I respond, really, the fact that it looks like a bomb went off in your bathroom didn't give you a clue that something was wrong?
Unrelated.
Because
totally
that is
unrelated.
One of the weird things about the movie. Sometimes their teleporting makes it look like a bomb has gone off, and sometimes
it's
just
really destructive.
Yeah, sometimes they just seamlessly jump in without making a mark. The film is
very
inconsistent.
Hayden Christensen. I know, it's true.
Yeah, the film is
maybe
extremely...
he's just really bad at it.
You know what, maybe. Do you know what I think by far the most interesting thing about that film? Is that the actor who plays child Hayden Christensen is a much better actor than Hayden Christensen.
Aww,
I know it's a mean thing to say, but if you watch that movie, like, when he's a child, you believe he has emotions and cares about things and is conflicted and, you know, all of that. But when he's an adult, he's just a complete blank slate.
Yeah.
Like, I honestly wish that the whole movie had just been about teen Hayden Christensen, and we hadn't got around to the part where Hayden Christensen was the star, because he's a terrible actor. Which, again, it sounds like I'm being excessively cruel, but I think it's fair to describe him as a terrible actor.
Well, I don't know, because it's just a terrible role.
Well, when have you ever seen him good in anything?
I don't watch a lot of Hayden Christensen movies.
But you've seen him in all the Star Wars movies that he was terrible in.
Yeah. Again, terrible role.
Okay, actually, do you know what you have to see? And this is going to be a very mean thing to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, because as we have long since established, I'm a jerk. The greatest ever role for Hayden Christensen is his role in the film Awake, because it requires him to lie still. All it requires of him is to lie still on a table for an hour.
Aww,
finally, the perfect use of Hayden Christensen's thespian skills, lying flat on a table for an hour.
God.
I know. It seems very cruel to describe him as one of the worst working actors there is. But I'm sorry, he was terrible in this movie. And don't tell me it's all the bad part. You know what? Samuel Jackson had a bad part in that movie, and he was still entertaining. If you're a good actor who can do entertaining things, I mean, you can't save a movie, but you can at least make your scenes in the movie watchable. Like, a good actor can never save a bad script, but he can make a bad script watchable.
Yeah.
And Hayden Christensen...
He can do a good job with a bad script.
That's what I'm saying.
Hayden Christensen did a bad job with a bad script.
Exactly. And he has done bad jobs with good scripts, too. I mean, you haven't seen any of those movies, but they exist.
Yeah.
So if there's one thing I'm trying to make a point here, and it seems like I have a lot of points to make about this movie, is that Hayden Christensen's acting was so bad, it made me want Samuel Jackson to succeed in killing him. So perhaps that's the real story about my disdain for the film's morality, is the acting of him was so bad that it makes me want to have Hayden Christensen killed by Samuel Jackson. Which, you know, because of that time, I guess, Hayden Christensen killed him in Star Wars.
So really just a chance for him to get back.
Get his own back. What I find interesting here is that you and I seem to have both absolutely hated this film, but in very different ways. But we both admit that it's a terrible movie whose biggest sin is that it's extremely boring. Whereas I find the morality objectionable, whereas you find the stupidity objectionable.
Yes. That's exactly right.
But will you at least give me? Will you at least give me that it seems to be the first ever film made telling a story from the supervillain's point of view?
Maybe the first that I've seen.
Okay. Well, maybe there's another. But
if that is in fact the case.
Because if you admit to that, completely cooperate with your stupidity argument by listing the stupidest moment in the entire movie. Okay, so you will give me that it is a film told from the supervillain's point of view, correct?
Yes.
Okay,
but can we admit that he's a very bad supervillain?
Oh, no, I'm not saying he's a good supervillain, but, you know, it's like it's not every supervillain isn't Doctor Doom. If you read Spider-Man, like, 50% of his villains are just guys who put on suits and rob banks, which is exactly what Hayden Christensen does. He doesn't have a suit, but he's just a guy who teleports around robbing banks. Like, that's his only activity, and that's enough to make you a supervillain. Okay, moving...
But that doesn't make Samuel L. Jackson the superhero.
No, it doesn't. I would never suggest that. But it is a film about a supervillain.
Okay, good. I want to get that clear.
So, A,
all right. Okay,
supervillain...
So stupidest moment.
It is a film about a supervillain, but B, being a film about a supervillain does not make the antagonist a superhero. Can we agree on that?
Okay.
We can agree
on that. That would make it... Yeah, then I guess it's more of an anti-hero
kind
of situation.
Exactly.
In which there is, in fact, no hero.
Exactly. It's one of those movies where there's a film without a hero, which is fine. But he's actually a supervillain in the comic book sense of the word, correct?
Okay. Yes.
Okay, good. All right, so now the stupidest moment in the movie. They are in Jamie Bell's, and I want to point this out, he refers to it as his secret lair, which I'm like, you know, only villains have lairs, right? Heroes generally don't have lairs. But anyway, moving on from the specific term he uses to describe it. They're in his secret lair, and Samuel Jackson and I think two other paladins have followed through their jump scar into that lair. Right? And so Hayden Christensen is hiding behind a wall, And then, because he knows that guys with guns and knives and shock sticks are wandering around in the same room as him looking to try and kill him, okay? He doesn't just teleport away, mm-hmm. not getting into that. But then while hiding, he notices that in all of Jamie Bell's surveillance photos, there are pictures of his mother. And what does he do when he sees those pictures of his mother? He, like, walks out of
he
his hiding place.
He crosses the room
place.
To go look at it.
Like, he walks out of his hiding place and walks over to the picture. And he's like, why are there pictures of my mother here? He says out loud. Did you forget that you're being chased by people who want to murder you? And he had, because then he gets attacked. So I think it is fair to call that the stupidest scene in the entire movie. In fact, yeah. I'm watching it right
now. Yeah, and when I went watching that happen, I thought to myself, this is incredibly stupid.
Yeah, because now I'm looking at it. I'm looking at the scene, which, for those of you listening at home, is 1 hour and 8.5 minutes into the movie. He just walks. He sees his mother's picture, walks right over to it, and immediately gets caught by a shock stick. Like,
yeah.
What did you think was going to happen?
Look, I know, he kind of deserves to get caught.
Yeah, so if nothing else, if we can agree on nothing else about this movie, we can agree that it is about one of the stupidest characters in the history of cinema.
Yes.
I think that is a fair...
And again, I argue because he's a high school dropout.
So you're saying it might be one of the persuasive arguments, most persuasive arguments ever to get people to say stay in school?
Exactly. To not make stupid decisions like that in the future.
Because that way in the future, you won't say, hey, what's going on here when you see something odd while you're hiding from murderers.
Exactly.
Oh, Jumper. Okay, so I think that concludes our thoughts on the film Jumper, although I would like to plug an upcoming article on Castle Vargilon, vargilon.blogspot.com, where I'm going to, you know that scene at the end of the film where Hayden Christensen and Jamie Bell are jumping around the whole world chasing each other? Mm-hmm. You're familiar with this scene? I am going to watch that scene to see if the time zones make sense.
Oh, I noticed that, and they do.
Are you sure they do?
That really bothers me. Yeah. When you're watching a movie, and, like, you know, people are in two different time zones,
and
but it's
still
like same
there.
Time.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the worst. So I don't know. I mean, I was not watching closely, so I don't know if they make sense. But given the general ineptitude with every other part of that, with which every other part of that movie was made, I doubt that they do make sense.
No, I think this is the one thing they paid attention to.
Well, you say that, but I don't understand how, and bear with me here, I don't understand how it could be night in Rome and day in Kosovo.
They don't jump at night.
Yeah, they do.
No,
during the big fights. During the big fight scene in Rome,
the big
they have
fight scene takes place in the desert.
No. The beginning of the big fight scene takes place in the desert. Then they have the chase around the world for who gets the bomb detonator.
Right.
And that's the chase around the world that I want to see if it makes sense. Because in one shot, and this is the reason that I thought it didn't make sense, because in one shot they're fist fighting back at the Colosseum and it's night. But like two shots later, the big finale of it is in Kosovo, and it seems to be the middle of the day. And considering that Kosovo, I think, is like 2 hours east of Rome, that didn't make sense to me. Anyway, we don't have to worry about that now. I'm going to check the whole thing myself, and we'll find out for sure which one it is. Okay,
yes.
So that wraps it up for the AVOD tonight.
I just want to say I want to send this particular episode out to our one listener out there in internet land. I'll give that to you.
We have one fan who, like clockwork, records all of these, and we would just like to say thank you very much. And if you'll send us an email identifying yourself, we will. Well, we probably won't give out your name because that would make you unpopular with other people.
But we will continue to shout out to you.
We will continue to shout out to you specifically. So. Look forward to that. All right. Thank you for listening. Absolutely. Everyone who is. And until next time, you can find our blogs at Vargelon.blogspot.com.
Bamborg.blogspot.com and Zombot.blogspot.com. And I'd like to announce the AVOD blog, which is the AVOD at blogspot.com.
Yep, the AVOD now has its own blog up and running, which is great.
Its own home.
You can get it there, or of course at the posts linking to it on Vargelon.com, or even Vargelon.blogspot.com, or even searching for the word AVOD on Google. That's right. The AVOD has now been around long enough that searching on Google will let you find it. I mean, it'll come after all of the references to audio and video on demand, which is apparently a popular acronym that we did not know about when we named our AVOD. But
but it's there, nevertheless.
But it is there. It is there.
It is there.
Very deep in that list of... in that list of results for the AVOD. You know what? Add a Vargelon in there when you're searching for the AVOD on Google, and it'll get you right there.
Yep.
All right. Until next time, we will see you soon. And you can always, as always, you can email any questions or comments to Vargelon@gmail.com. Although, come to think of it, we should really start a theavod@gmail.com. Get on that dive, mistress.
We'll get around to it.
All right.
Okay.
Have a good night, everybody.
Good night.